Counsel?
Good morning, Judge Foley, Judge Fujise, and Judge Ginoza. May it please the court. My name is Robert Nakatsuji, and I am a Deputy Solicitor General in the Appellate Division of the Department of the Attorney General. I'm appearing today as amicus curiae in this case. Initially, I'd like to thank the court for allowing me the opportunity to participate in oral argument today. I'd also like to thank the Kauai Prosecuting Attorney's Office for agreeing to share a portion of their time. Your Honors, I'm appearing today to emphasize the importance of this case and the importance of the interests involved in this case. My presentation today, like my written amicus brief, focuses on the balancing of interests portion of the analysis. State versus Pratt held that the state interests have to be balanced against the Native Hawaiian interests in cases like this. In my view, Your Honor, the circuit court failed to consider the most important state interest, public safety. If the court compares Pratt to the present case.
And how was that raised below?
Your Honor, I believe it was raised below in the state's written response to the motion. The state relies on the ICA's Pratt decision. And if you look at the ICA's Pratt decision, it's really about the balancing test.
That's no, but in terms of the public safety, how did the state put forth below what public safety interest was threatened?
Well,
in
Your
particular?
Honor, I would argue that, again, by citing Pratt, the state was relying on the arguments in Pratt. And not only did Pratt deal with the balancing test, but Pratt also dealt with
no public safety interest in particular was asserted below.
I would admit that the arguments could have been raised in a clearer manner, but I would argue that they were sufficiently raised because they relied on Pratt.
But you're not pointing anything out to me other than Pratt. Pratt gives the balancing test, the totality of circumstances, but you have to point to something specific.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that by pointing to Pratt, they were raising public safety because public safety was, or at least public health and safety, were issues raised in Pratt.
You know, in Pratt, though, they had a witness testify, right? Somebody from DLNR, I believe it was, or from the state, who testified to the health effects of having too many people in the area, et cetera, et cetera. So there was evidence in the record. So I think that the challenge in this case is there's no, it's uncontested, there's no evidence in this record as to a public safety concern, just argument, right?
Your Honor, I do recognize that the record could have been developed better in this case. However, I think the court can still look at the state's interest, including public safety. I would argue that what we're dealing with in looking at the state's interests is legislative facts. We're not dealing with adjudicative facts. What happened to whom and where and why, all of that stuff relating to the immediate parties is not really at issue when you're talking about the state interests. I think here we're dealing with broader policymaking issues, questions that are much broader and don't relate specifically to the party. So questions like, is hunting potentially dangerous? Are wild pigs potentially dangerous? The implications of firearms. All of these things are broad issues that I think an appellate court can look at.
Shouldn't we decide this case on the facts of this case? In other words, there's no firearm involved in this particular case, correct? Why should we go beyond the record in that regard? Or can we go beyond the record?
Your Honor, I do recognize that Mr. Palama was not hunting with a firearm in this case. However, I do think that the implications of firearms are inescapable. I think the court has to confront them. And that's because, for one thing, other people on the land could be using firearms. Although Mr. Palama didn't, the landowner or people on the land with the permission of the landowner could be hunting with firearms. And if that happens, the Native Hawaiian hunter could be accidentally shot. You know, we're talking about public safety here, and the Native Hawaiian hunter is part of the public, and we don't want a Native Hawaiian hunter to be injured or killed any more than an innocent bystander.
You know, in the 1978 Constitutional Convention, when they adopted Section 7, or proposed it, of Article 12, they talked about the state have the power to regulate, but not to regulate it away. If you give unfettered discretion to the landowner to either grant or deny permission, isn't that essentially denying someone access because they could have exercised their traditional practices prior to 78 if a landowner gave permission? That would have essentially meant that if you give unfettered discretion to the landowner, 78 Concon Amendment means nothing.
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's not complete. It's not a complete elimination of the Native Hawaiian right. I think that there is room for Native Hawaiians to exercise their rights. I think in this particular case, Mr. Palama could have gone hunting with the permission of the landowner. And there's no indication in the record that he couldn't do that.
But didn't the 78 Concon and the cases thereafter is in Pash basically doing away with the consent of the landowner? Isn't that what it's all about? If you have the consent of the landowner, you don't have tradition and custom without the consent of the landowner. And that's the very thing the 78 Concon was trying to obviate.
Well, Your Honor, I think what the 1978 Constitutional Convention was doing was they were trying to balance the Native Hawaiian interests with the realities of modern life. And I think that that's also what the Kalipi Court was doing in imposing an undeveloped land requirement.
I'm a resident of Akuleana, and you own the Ahupuaha, and I'm dependent on you whether I can go outside my Akuleana. I don't have any rights.
Well, Your Honor, I think that in this case, Mr. Palama could have, in fact, gone pig hunting. I think there's no indication that he wouldn't have gotten permission. Even if the Robinsons refused permission, he could go hunting on another landowner's land, and that landowner may have given him permission. In fact, pigs are so destructive to the land that I think it's likely that other landowners would give permission. Furthermore, he could have gone hunting on public land.
Let me ask you this. One of the things that we've been asked to address recently is taking judicial notice of certain things. What is your position on that? If, for instance, the kingdom laws in place back in the monarchy and the kingdom period, what is your position on that?
Your Honor, I think the court can take judicial notice, particularly of the kingdom laws, because those are laws, and so the court can take judicial notice of law.
How does that play with your legislative fact argument? I'm not quite following how that may play into your legislative fact
argument. Well, Your Honor, legislative facts, they don't require you to take judicial notice of them. The court can just look at them because, again, they don't involve the immediate parties. They're dealing with issues of law and policymaking. Appellate courts very often take a look at studies, articles, reports. They don't bother to take judicial notice of them. They look at them because they involve legislative facts.
So your argument is they're two separate
issues? I think they're distinct concepts, Your Honor. But the court can both take a look at a particular fact as a legislative fact, but it can also take judicial notice of it. And I think the court could do both in this case because the facts that I'm arguing really can't be disputed. I don't think anyone can dispute that hunting is potentially dangerous, that wild pigs are potentially dangerous. Hunting is regulated. Hunting is a licensed activity. You have to get a license. You also have to take a hunter education class. And these requirements are in recognition of the fact that hunting is potentially dangerous.
I think the challenge, as you note, though, is it's a balance. It's a balance with recognizing legitimate traditional cultural rights on the other side, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I do understand that. And Hawaiian rights can be exercised in other ways. There are going to be many instances where exercising Hawaiian rights is not going to implicate public safety. This is a special case because we're dealing with hunting wild animals and firearms.
But not firearms. Yeah. Why don't you pass a regulation or a statute essentially saying if you have a firearm, you need consent? How about that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think you can do that because of the way that we regulate hunting in this state. There is really no distinction between the methods of hunting. You know, you get a hunting license for hunting in general. It doesn't specify different methods of hunting, and it's because hunting in general.
You don't think the state could enact a statute saying that if you're hunting with a firearm, you need permission. If you're hunting with a knife, you don't?
I think the state could, but I don't think it would be warranted because I think there are general risks involved in hunting. And I think when you're dealing with those kinds of risks, the balancing test weighs in favor of the state. And I think it would be difficult to try to draw the line between firearms and other forms of hunting, because I believe they all carry risks.
Well, if you have so much risk, how come you're giving all the discretion to the private landowner?
Well, Your Honor,
it's not the state.
I can address that, Your Honor. The private landowner, he has that authority because he knows the land better than anybody else. You know, with public land, you can specify your safety requirements and tailor them to the conditions on the land. And so if you look at the regulations, you'll see different methods of hunting for different areas. You'll see safety zones. You'll see permitting requirements. All of these things are tailored to each hunting area. But with, if I could finish, Your Honor. But with private land, it's left to the landowner because the landowner knows the conditions on his or her piece of land better than anybody else.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Murakami.
May it please the court, Tracy Murakami, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the County of Kauai for Appellant State of Hawaii. If there is one word that we can use to describe the circuit court's dismissal order in this case, the word is imprecise. The effect of this court's order is to elevate feral pig hunting as a Native Hawaiian right incident to kuleana lot ownership. Yet the court's order doesn't explicitly acknowledge this expansion of rights. And the court is clearly grappling with the facts and issues in this case. And as one of the deputy prosecutors, that's the problem that I have. It's that this order isn't clear about some of these issues. In this case, in conclusion of law two, the court cites to Kalipi, and for the proposition that lawful occupants of an ahupua'a may enter undeveloped lands within the ahupua'a to gather specifically enumerated items. However, in Kalipi, the term lawful occupant means one who resides within the ahupua'a. In this case, there was no evidence that Mr. Palama resides in Hana Pepe Valley. There was actually no evidence at all of where he resides on Kauai. So the circuit court erred in concluding that pursuant to Kalipi, Mr. Palama is an occupant of the ahupua'a where Hana Pepe Valley is located. In Kalipi, the court specifically rejects Mr. Kalipi's position that based on his ownership of kuleana lots, he had a right to gather indigenous products, kukui nuts, kiawe, tea leaf, bamboo, from within the ahupua'a in which his lots were located. The circuit court in our case made no attempt to distinguish this case from the facts in Kalipi.
Ms. Murakami, in Pele Defense Fund, though, the Supreme Court recognized that customary traditional rights could belong to Native Hawaiians outside of the ahupua'a, at least as articulated in that case, right?
Correct. But okay. Still, it was tied to a tradition of access by those who reside in a budding ahupua'a. And so there is no evidence in this case of a tradition in Hana Pepe Valley or anywhere on Kauai of feral pig hunting as incident to kuleana lot ownership.
You know, one of the challenges in this case, though, we're dealing with criminal process, criminal defendant rights balanced against these larger constitutional issues. And your challenge, of course, is that at trial in this case, there was no evidence presented by the state. And that I don't think this argument was raised below. Was this argument raised below in the trial court? And if not, why should we address it now?
The specific argument of tying the pig hunting specifically to kuleana lot ownership?
Oh, right, or to somebody who does not reside in the ahupua'a,
well,
where the crime allegedly
occurred. For the three-part hanapitas, that is the defendant's burden. And so in picking up this case, if you're defense counsel, If that is your theory of the case, that his, or at least it was the circuit court's, that his status as an occupant of a kuleana lot in Hana Pepe Valley is part of why he gets this privilege, then that tradition should be, he should have put it in the record. It wasn't the state's burden to show that custom. It was his tradition to show that custom.
So your argument is that there's no evidence in the record that he was either resident of the same ahupua'a,
yes,
Okay, and that regardless of the state making that issue, raising that issue below, that it is something viable for this court. Why wouldn't it have been waived? Why is that not a waiver issue? I mean, even though it's his burden, doesn't the state have an obligation to raise the issues that it feels is important?
Well, I think part of the problem in going through the case law, as I'm sure this court's aware, is with the second prong of Hanapi, it's that what is the defendant's burden in showing the scope of a tradition? Is it merely that feral pig hunting is a tradition, period? Or is it feral pig hunting is a tradition in Hanapepe Valley? Or is it that feral pig hunting in Hanapepe Valley with unleashed dogs? You know, what is the scope? How specific do you have to be to show the tradition?
Well, in this case, you have Professor Osorio.
Yes.
Clearly an expert, University of Hawaii, Hawaiian Studies Department, uncontroverted expert testimony essentially stating this was a tradition and practice that would come under Section 7, Article 12, that goes back prior to 1892. And that's uncontroverted. There's nothing to the contrary.
Yes, his testimony, though, was about this tradition generally. He had no evidence about Kauai or Hanapepe Valley. And it, clearly, feral pig hunting, you know, wouldn't have arisen simultaneously on the various islands. But I realize his testimony was that the tradition arose in Hawaii prior to 1892. But we don't have any testimony about a tradition of feral pig hunting incident to Kuleana lot ownership where taro was raised. You know, does the fact that it was also very unclear in the record, what does the taro farming have to do with the feral pig hunting? Shouldn't there be a relationship between the two if the part of the court's reasoning and one of the salient facts was that he was an occupant of the valley by nature of owning the Kuleana lot and raising taro thereon? Shouldn't there be a relationship between the pig hunting and the taro farming if the taro farming on the Kuleana lot now gives him the right to feral pig hunt within the valley?
Okay, so just so that I'm real clear, I'm looking at conclusion of law number 2, which you cite, which references Kalipi. Yeah. I don't see a reference to Kuleana lots here. It talks about lawful Native Hawaiian occupants of an ahupua'a.
Thank you. And, Your Honor, again, one of my problems is the word Kuleana, I don't believe, appears anywhere in the court's order. So we have an implicit expansion of rights. Shouldn't this be explicit? If we're going to say that, and the court is clearly finding he's an occupant of the valley, I think the only way that he's an occupant is by nature of owning that Kuleana lot. So shouldn't the court's order acknowledge that that's the basis for his right? And there's no evidence of any tradition of, again, feral pig hunting is tied into Kuleana lot ownership where taro is.
Well, what about Mr. Palama's own testimony in this case, that it's been a practice in his own family generationally going back? Well, how do you address that?
So,
how does that fit into
your
argument?
And I think that is the imprecision of the order, is the court finding that because he himself, as a man born in 1984, so as a child, let's say in the 90s, started, you know, accessing Hanapepe Valley for hunting, does that give him the right? But the court's order is specifically finding that he's an occupant. So the court seemed to be focusing the right on the ownership of the Kuleana lot rather than a childhood practice of accessing this area for hunting. And it's the imprecision that is the problem.
Well, you know what, part of the challenge too is that none of this was argued either in below or in the opening brief or anywhere in the briefing in this case. That's part of the challenge we have in, you know, in a typical criminal case, arguments that are not raised below may be waived, right? And so that's part of the challenge here. We recognize, I think, that this case involves important constitutional rights that require us to think hard about these things. Right. But we can't throw out the fact that this is a criminal case and Mr. Palama is entitled to appropriate criminal process.
Right. And so, you know, if the court is so inclined, the state would be in favor of a remand to shore up these issues. We don't know where Mr. Palama resides. He could reside in Haena, for all we know, and he drives hours to get to the Kuleana lot.
You know, the remand is an interesting question, because had this gone to trial, and essentially this was really a mini trial,
right,
because most motions to dismiss are based on declarations, not live testimony and cross-examination. So it seems, smells like, tastes like, looks like, say, criminal trial. If it was a criminal trial and an acquittal, we couldn't remit. It'd be double jeopardy. Is there an issue here? I mean, it essentially was a trial. Right. I mean, the prima facie of the case of the state is undisputed. You know, he was hunting. He didn't have permission. It wasn't his land.
Right. That is true.
So wouldn't that
You're saying technically it is a dismissal order that can be remanded. Especially, I feel like the cases that have come before us and the cases post-PASH don't shore up the issue of non-residents' rights. And they certainly don't, you know, there's certainly no clarity with regard to Kuleana lot ownership and the scope of gathering. Again, there's nothing post-PASH that is
You know, helpful. In all candor, I think you're raising some interesting points that would have been very helpful had they been raised below. So not only the court could consider it, but Mr. Palama would be able to address it and then come within the totality of circumstances. It seems a little late in the game to be raising it for the first time before us, and a little unfair to Mr. Palama.
I'll acknowledge that, Your Honor. Yes. So, you know, one of obviously the court's or the state's problems is the issue of ownership of the Kuleana lot, where Mr. Palama resides, is unclear in the record. The other thing that the state wants to emphasize is there are public hunting grounds as provided in the DLNR regulations throughout the island. And in fact, in looking at the map of hunting grounds near Hanapipe Valley, there are hunting grounds, I think it's Unit C and E. Coincidentally, Mr. Palama was hunting on, it was a Monday, January 17th in 2011. And so in pulling out the regulations, I asked myself, well, could he have hunted on this particular day in Units C and E? And the answer is yes. Those hunting days are year-round. They are Saturdays, Sundays, and public holidays. January 17th, 2011 was Martin Luther King Day. It's a state holiday. So in fact, you know, there are other venues for him to hunt.
Where is the location of the public hunting areas again?
So the public hunting areas for feral pig hunting are throughout the island. So in looking at the maps and looking at Hanapipe Valley, it's Unit C and E, and there's a Lihui, I think it's called Lihui Koloa Forest Reserve. I believe it's a piece of Unit C that is closest to Hanapipe Valley. And again, we have Mr. Palama testifying that on the day in question, he drove somewhere, he drove from his home, presumably, to his Kuleana lot with his mule, and then parked on his Kuleana lot, and then hunted from there. So he is driving from somewhere on the island to his lot, and then hunting from his Kuleana lot. It is true that Mr. Palama had a number of experts, but again, it's not clear in the record. And Dr. Osorio did not testify about a link between feral pig hunting and growing taro on one's Kuleana lot. And I think that is relevant not only to the second part of the Hanapi test, but to the totality of circumstances. There was no evidence put on by the state about the use of dogs. The dogs, it appears in the record, are unleashed because Mr. Palama says the dogs go after the pig, and then I follow the dogs. So we have unleashed dogs. We don't know how many. It's dogs, plural, so it's at least two.
Is there any evidence in the record as to how large this private property is? And should that matter?
And again, maybe that's something to shore up for the record. No, so and it's also not in the record the distance that Mr. Palama traversed on the property for hunting. We know that he left at 7 o'clock in the morning. We know that he killed two pigs. We don't know, you know, how far he went, which I think is relevant. Is it an all-day affair or it's, you know, a shorter affair? That's not clear. So although the state didn't put on evidence about, you know, the harm of unleashed dogs. I think that is something that must be considered in the totality of circumstances.
The lower court should have considered it, even though the state didn't raise it?
Well, but it's, I mean, it's in the record. You know, he's hunting with unleashed dogs. And the nature of hunting on someone else's property is qualitatively different than a right of pedestrian access and gathering agricultural products. In PASH, the question was access to ponds to gather shrimp. The ponds, by and large, don't move. I mean, I think maybe depending on the tide.
But isn't it the state's burden to take on the preferred defense, not the courts? Courts should sort of be a neutral.
But I still think the court has to balance respective interests and recognizing that hunting, the activity of hunting, is qualitatively different than a right of access.
The 1978 Constitutional Convention specifically mentions hunting in wild animals. It's a tradition or custom.
Yes. Yes. So again, the facts about, you know, the distance that he's going and the time that is spent on the property, those are salient facts.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hempe.
Very nice. May it please the court. Dan Hempe for Cleve Palama. One of the main themes running through my brief is what the court's been asking a lot of questions about now, which is how can the court err by not considering things that weren't brought to the
attention? Speak up a little bit so everybody can hear?
One of the themes that we've been saying over and over here is that this is a criminal case, and how can the circuit court have erred by not considering things that it wasn't asked to consider? And I submit that the danger in this case isn't that affirming, you know, creates the risk of remote descendants setting their dogs loose everywhere and wreaking havoc throughout the state. That wouldn't be a traditional and customary practice. But the danger in this case is setting a precedent that allows the state to get second bites at the apple when they don't put forward a case below. It goes to the heart of how criminal law works. Questions that the Hawaii courts have said, questions that merely lurk in the record that weren't brought to the attention of the court and weren't ruled on, are not considered to have been decided as to constitute precedents. All these arguments today weren't before the court, and your honors have to decide if Judge Watanabe erred by not considering them.
Well, didn't the Mr. Palama, by moving to dismiss as opposed to going to trial, leave the opportunity? Let's say the motion to dismiss was improperly granted. As a general matter, can it be remanded for a trial?
Generally, I'm not saying if the state.
Yeah, you know, and if this were a trial, obviously there'd be no appeal.
Right, clear.
So why didn't this go to trial as opposed to be disposed of by a motion to dismiss?
I can't say what the defense lawyer below, why he chose that particular tact, but nonetheless, I think in the context of the motion to dismiss, the court would assume that the elements of the offense were met, and the motion to dismiss was based purely on the defense, the constitutional defense. So with respect to the constitutional defense, the court ruled based on what was before it. No, I don't know. I think it's an interesting question as, you know, whether in this context jeopardy could have attached or not. It's not, wasn't raised by anybody until now. So again, I think we get to the point of, with respect to this defense, did the court err?
What about the court not taking judicial notice of this 1874 Hawaiian Kingdom law? I think it's cited in Robinson's amicus curiae brief about wild animals belonging to the owner of the property. You know, that's not an issue of fact. That's law. You know, and how would that impact Mr. Osorio's testimony about tradition and custom, and the Section 7, Article 12, about tradition and customs prior to 1892, where this act was prior to that. How does that come into play, if at all?
Okay. Well, first of all, again, I keep harping on it, but it wasn't brought before the trial court. So without waiving any of these issues, if the court had taken judicial notice of these various laws relating to traditional and customary practices, the court would have noticed that the, first of all, the court would have noticed that the law the Robinsons put in that says there must be landowner permission before hunting took effect January 1st, 1893, and we're dealing with a cutoff date of December 23rd, 1892.
I'm talking about the prior statute.
The prior statute says that if somebody has animals that they own and they don't put identification on them and they roam onto someone else's land and they stay there for more than 6 months, they become the property of the landowner. None of that's here. We don't have a theft of animals case here. We have a hunting without a permit case. That's what the prior statute said. But frankly, if we go before that and we look at the 1851 amendment to the Kuleana Act, the legislature there specifically removed the landowner requirement, the landowner permission requirement in 1851. So I think that it kind of illustrates the danger of arguing things that weren't before the court. You know, the Robinsons put in one law, but if you go back 40 more years, you see that there was no landowner permission requirement.
Mr. Hempe, you know, part of the argument you're making is that we should decide this case on the facts as presented and the arguments presented in this case. So I guess what one thing I'm curious to know is if Mr. Palamo or somebody else goes on to the Robinson property and is again charged, would that case simply be based on the facts and evidence in that case? In other words, would it not be fair to say that then this case is limited to the specific facts and evidence that was presented here? Or do you have a different view of that?
You know, my view is what the court says in Pratt and other cases, which is that the court is to look at these cases on a case-by-case basis. I mean, I think that's the law in the state. If we were, you know, a new, if there's, and I think when we look at the issue of did the lower court err, I think it's an improper part of the analysis to think, you know, well, what might happen in another case, another hypothetical case down the road. That's kind of goes to the same thing as you know, the guns. You know, the state's wanting to say, well, you know, they're going to start next. It's guns. I don't think we get that when we're doing a case by case analysis. You know, on this record, you know, was the court clearly erroneous when it decided that this was a traditional and customary practice?
Because the kingdom laws in place back in the 1800s may in fact be a salient consideration for what the traditional custom and practices were. Would you agree with that?
I think in some other case where the state brings that up at the right time, yes. But again, we're asking, you know, we're deciding whether a lower court erred by not considering something that it didn't know. And that's just fundamentally unfair. I think that puts too much burden on the defendant, frankly. You know, you have someone who's charged with a crime, the state can incarcerate them. You know, they're saying these are my traditional customary rights, they prove it. Then you get to appeal, the state starts trying at least, and the amicus to add new evidence into the appeal. You know, and then they seek remand to add new evidence again. I mean, you know, at what point does it stop? I think it's put, you know, in the context of a criminal case, we decide cases based on the evidence in the record. I've been on the wrong side of that enough times to know. We see a lot of opinions where the defendant didn't raise something and his appeal is denied because he didn't raise it below. But, you know, basic concepts of waiver. The other thing that I mentioned, and I got appointed essentially at the time of the reply brief, is the statute, it's 701.115, which essentially tells the lower court how to look at defenses. And one point it's caused me to think a lot lately. It asked, mentioned to the court is there's two different standards. There's standards for affirmative defenses, and there's standards for non-affirmative defenses. We have a statute that actually lists affirmative defenses, and this is not in that statute. But just recently, in rereading Pratt and the Armitage case, I represented both of them. I noticed that the Supreme Court mentioned it as an affirmative defense. So if a defense is, the statute says, 701.115, if a defense is an affirmative defense, the defendant is entitled to acquittal if the trier of fact finds that the evidence, when considered in light of any contrary prosecution evidence, proves by a preponderance the facts which negative penal liability. So if we look at this, if we take the Supreme Court's interpretation that this is an affirmative defense, the question again is, did the court err? And the court was supposed to consider the defense evidence in light of any contrary prosecution evidence. And in this case, there was none. There was no contrary prosecution evidence.
The Attorney General's office raises and really focuses just on the totality of circumstances analysis recognized in Pratt. So not questioning that Mr. Palama has met the three requirements under Hanapi. But so with regards to just the totality of the circumstances analysis, can you address the state's argument on the public safety issue? Because recognizing that we'll have to scour the record to see to the extent that it was properly raised below and to what effect that will have. But this case is different than the gathering cases that have come before the appellate courts before. Would you not agree with that?
I can't wholesale adopt that because, as one of your honors mentioned, the 1978 convention specifically mentions hunting as one of the protected rights. But to address your idea, I guess just generally about the totality, we have rights protected since at least 1851 by kingdom law. We've got the 1978 convention that affirms them. Recently, I don't want to go outside the record with the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, but we've got, and we have the state arguing today, if they're out there without landowner permission, the private landowner might accidentally shoot the cultural practitioner if they're hunting. Well, I have to take issue with that because they could make the same argument and say the landowner might accidentally shoot the cultural practitioner who's harvesting tea or harvesting thatch. It's this thing that we're going to take away your rights to ensure you're protected and you're safe. There's nothing in this record that suggests even that Mr. Palama hunted in an unsafe manner. There's nothing to say in this record to say his dogs can't discern between a pig and a small child. There's nothing in this record to show that the Robinsons might have shot him accidentally. So, I don't think we can divorce the facts of the case from the totality of the circumstances. In fact, the trial court found that he hunted in a reasonable manner. So, absent some evidence that there was something really unsafe here, I don't think we even get there. I think that the totality favors the appellate. Hope I answered your question. And actually, a little bit more about the totality as I think about it. It's an interesting legal concept because if we look at it historically, and a lot of this is in PASH, and I have another opinion. And State versus Zimming, that's the one I was thinking of. Hawaii Revised Statute 1-1 codifies Hawaiian usage as an exception to the English common law. And the reason we had that, you know, historically, is the Hawaiians didn't have this private land concept. They didn't consider people who entered their land to be trespassers. They didn't kick them off. But as land started being sold to foreigners, eventually the foreigners started adopting that position and fencing out the native Hawaiians. And the chiefs and the vili and the king became concerned, so they specifically protected these subsistence rights of the Maka'ainana. You know, the 99%ers could still eat, they could still survive. It goes, so if we're looking at the totality, that actually goes directly to the protections in this case, that the testimony in this case was it was for food to feed the family. So, and also I say, to the extent this, you know, the state has an affirmative obligation to protect these rights, to protect them. I submit that forcing criminal defendants to, you know, relitigate issues on appeal and remand that weren't raised below runs afoul of that affirmative obligation to protect, or stretching the facts to include hypothetical scenarios of you know, multiple groups with guns taking over the forest. That doesn't protect.
So let's take a step back. Ms. Murakami, in her argument, raises the question of whether the trial court's findings and conclusions here with regards to whether Mr. Palama either is an occupant of the Ahupua'a or as to where he resides, whether that's significant in this case. And granted, we all recognize the record is what it is, but assuming that those are significant issues that we want to consider, what is your position in terms of the law, in terms of the rights of the Native Hawaiian claimant, in terms of whether they reside in the Ahupua'a? And recognizing Kalipi held what it held, Pele Defense Fund held what it held with regards to an occupant of the Ahupua'a, where does this case, how should we think about this case in light of those particular opinions?
Again, I apologize for being a broken record, but you know, we have to decide. I think we have to analyze it based on the facts that were before the court in this case.
Ms. Murakami argues that there's no evidence as to where Mr. Palama resides.
And I submit that the court wasn't clearly erroneous in affording him these protections based on the evidence that he's been doing it his whole life, his father has been doing it his whole life there, his grandfather has been doing it his whole life there. You know, he took it back several generations, and I submit that the Pele Defense Fund case recognized the traditional and customary practices could extend to other Ahupua'a. So, you know, based on this record, I don't think there's enough, I submit there's not enough to say that the trial court was clearly erroneous in how it ruled. And I think finally I say that, you know, as to the balancing test, again, I submit there's not enough to, in this record, to say that the state proved that the court misbalanced Mr. Palama's rights versus the state's right to regulate. I would agree with the court that the legislature certainly can begin regulating in a way that doesn't extinguish rights. And I would also parrot or mirror the argument that leaving it completely up to the landowner amounts to an extinguishment of the rights. It just means the money makes the decision, and that's really not what was protected back in 1851, back in 1978, and in Pash. I could go on about, you know, the more the state allows development, the more protections the Native Hawaiians should have to enter and gather, but again, I think I'm getting kind of afar from the facts in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Hampton.
I don't have anything else.
Okay. No more questions?
No.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ms. Murakami?
I would like to draw the court's attention to conclusion of law number 10, where the circuit court concluded that the government must protect the privilege of defendant to enter the subject's property because there was no evidence of actual harm being done by the defendant. So this case, or the court's order, is filed on April 26, 2012. I believe that State versus Pratt is decided in May of 2012. And so the no actual harm wasn't used by the court in Pratt. So that's just something that, you know, it looks like the court, in applying the no actual harm standard, is applying the standard that today is not the law. And so in looking in, so that alone should warrant a remand of applying the standard laid down or Pratt. And it's the balance of interest. And the fact that on this day in question, there was no actual harm isn't the entire analysis.
Well, in other respects, you're asking us, even though things weren't raised below, to consider it now. Well, can't we consider the record without remanding it, despite that reference
in
that
conclusion? This court certainly has the discretion to do so. And if the court is not going to remand, I guess the state would request that, you know, there are facts that are in the record, there are facts that are not. If the court would be very precise about what it's relying on so that we have guidance in future cases, you know, to analyze the case coming in and, you know, what precisely the court is relying on in making its decision. And so the state is in favor of a remand. It's in the best interest of this case to flesh out some of the salient facts that are not clear, and perhaps the lower court, you know, wasn't clear about, is it important where he resides? You know, is that important or is it not? And the state position that it is, and the court's essential conclusion that feral pig hunting is tied to Kuleana lot ownership or Tarawis Farm represents an expansion of the current state of the case law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Murakami. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.